Hey, everybody. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson. I'm the executive director of LRIS, and I'm going to be your host for this next little tour through a handful of cases coming out of the world of public safety labor relations from lots of different parts of the country. Some interesting stuff for everybody this month. Last month, as you may recall, if you didn't listen to it, go back and listen to it. We had a special episode. We just talked about guns and drugs. Two of our favorite subjects. This month, it's a little bit different. We're going to be a little bit of kind of a catch-all of a number of different cases bubbling up at the federal and the state level that we think have some value to you. So stick around for the April 2026 edition of First Thursday. Before we jump into the cases, let's talk a little bit about seminars. We have some great seminars coming up, including this month. We're going to be in Nashville for our Collective Bargaining for Public Safety Employees seminar. Our bargaining seminar is just a blast. You know, if you've never been to it, it's not too late to sign up and see us. Going to be there from April 15th to 17th at the Sonesta in Nashville. Nashville is a lot of fun. If you're not going to see us at bargaining, in April, we're going to be back in Nashville at the end of the year in November for a discipline seminar, 2.5 days, just discipline from the union and the management perspective. That's an interesting, seminar for people to check out. If you want to come out to Vegas, some people like coming out to Vegas. If you want to come out to Vegas and see us, we're going to be there in June from June 17th to the 19th for our Rights of Police Officers 2026, seminar. And that's for our law enforcement friends and talk about discipline rights, constitutional rights, privacy rights, AI. How does that fit in there? Brady, Giglio, all of that. We do over 2.5 days in a pretty fun place to have a seminar. And then we're going to be back in Vegas again for our enforcing the contract. That's grievances, discipline, other external rights. That's at the end of September, September 30th through October 2nd. Both of those seminars are going to be at the Horseshoe and the Paris in Vegas. If you want any information about them, check us out online, www.lrs.com/seminars. Okay, case number one this month comes from the great state of Ohio, home of the Buckeyes. It's called Shelton versus Cuyahoga Metropolitan Housing Authority. It's a federal case. The decision was issued by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a federal appellate court, just a few months ago. The case, I think it's a funny case just because of the facts, honestly. We've got a police officer doing stupid stuff on social media, right? So what's not to love? That is a case that we talk about, you know, LRIS. One thing that you can feel confident of, if you're a police officer or a firefighter or a correctional officer, and you do something stupid on social media, and there's a case that flows from it, I'm probably gonna be talking about it on the podcast. And so this is what, and I actually don't know this guy did anything stupid. We got a housing authority police officer in this particular case, who was a rapper on the side, and he had this side business where he would post his videos on YouTube. I don't think he could put them out in any other form. His thing is YouTube. You ever watch that show Neighbors on HBO, by the way? It's crazy. There's all these lunatics, you know, who live next to each other, getting into big fights, and half of them, they post stuff on YouTube and they make a ton of money just posting stupid videos on YouTube. So might be a side industry. This guy might have come up with a really good idea, and he starts posting provocative rap videos. So, you know, what do you mean by provocative, Rick? Well, he's got one video, it's called Headshot. And that's where he basically executes a homeless person on the street. A mock execution, not a real execution, right? But so the police officer executes a homeless man on the street. He also has one of my favorites, the Talk My Shit Challenge, which is just a potpourri of offensive stuff about women. He's got the Great Man Challenge, which involves him. He's basically in a gun. He's in a car. He's got a gun. He's got an open container of alcohol. These are just crazy, these videos. Throughout all of this on his YouTube page, he holds himself out as a Cuyahoga County housing police officer, right? He's in uniform in some of them. He says he's a police officer, you know, so there's no secrets here. And that's part of the gig, is like, look at the crazy stuff this police officer is doing. The problem is he's an actual police officer. And so what happens? He starts doing it. I don't know how many views. I should have looked up how many views he gets. He's probably doing fine, you know, on that website. But his colleagues get wind of it. Some of them don't like it. You know, rumors start floating around. The videos start floating around on, you know, my favorite, the Shift text chain, which is always a good source of cases for me. And so the videos start floating around. The department gets a hold of it. The chief doesn't like it. They launch an internal investigation. On the same day that they launched, they notify him of this internal investigation. He goes and he files a race discrimination complaint with the EEOC. And so whether that's a little bit of offense or a little bit of defense, I don't really know, but he files the charge. As the department moves forward with the investigation, they put him on administrative leave. They keep him in paid status, but they put him on the shelf. They say, stay at home. That's sometime in like the fall of 2020. And then January of 21 rolls around and they decide to fire him. And they fire him for social media policy violations and for the nature of the posts, et cetera, et cetera. Here's an interesting kind of thing to keep in mind why we're actually talking about this case. The department fires him in January of 2021. The union files a grievance. There's a just cause standard in the contract. They take his case to arbitration and they win and they get his job. They get it. He's reinstated. He gets his job back. And the big reason why he was successful was that there was no warning, you know, no rule saying you couldn't have this kind of off-duty type of conduct. There were no public complaints. It was just internal stuff. And so under just cause standards, under traditional just cause standards, this police officer got his job back. By the way, that reminds me, like 20 years ago, I remember getting a firefighter his job back. Similar facts. Rappin' Rodney was the guy's name. And he had, and back, you know, this guy, Shelton case, this is all like a lot of misogyny, right? You know, and violence. Rappin' Rodney, who was a firefighter in a big city, he was anti-police. And so he had lots of rap about like how he didn't like the police and he wanted to like burn the police and make them into bacon bits. And the police union in that town felt a certain way about it, as you might expect. And they complained and this, and the employer wound up firing the firefighter. And this was early days. He wasn't posting this on, I don't even know where he was posting, but he was putting the videos out there and, he gets fired. The union, you know, there's no First Amendment lawsuit. The union files a grievance, you know, case goes to arbitration. Yours truly is representing the union in a just cause case. And we got the guy's job back and we basically said, look, he was acting. The dude was acting. It's no different than like, what if he played Hannibal Lecter in a play? You're going to fire him for that? You know, it was pretend. Now, some of it was offensive, but it was acting. It was art. And the department didn't have any type of standards in place or training for people regarding what type of hobbies they could engage in off duty. And we were able to win that case. And old Rappin' Rodney, you know, went back to being a firefighter and probably he's probably retired by now. But so, you know, these things happen. These cases exist. Keep that in mind. Arbitration is always going to be your best bet. But so this officer in Cuyahoga County gets reinstated by an arbitrator. And then after all that stuff was done, he sued. He sued the county and basically he brought a discrimination case or a race discrimination allegation and said that, you know, you fired me because of my race, because you didn't treat, you know, similarly situated, other employees as bad as you did to me. And he also brought a First Amendment speech case, just basically saying, you know, my rapping, you know, my artistic activity is protected by the First Amendment and you retaliated against me in response to that. Now, here's the problem, you know, with this First Amendment case, because he waited, right, until he was fired and then he was reinstated and like all this time went by. He waited until everything was done before filing his lawsuit. And ultimately what the Sixth Circuit, you know, wound up doing on appeal, the same thing that the district court did, was they said that his suit was too late, right? There was a 2-year statute of limitations that began at his termination, you know, that started the clock ticking for when he could bring a lawsuit or whether he could bring a lawsuit again. You don't wait until the end of the process. And I could see someone thinking like, well, let me just like, you know, I'm challenging it, you know, under the grievance and arbitration procedure. Maybe that, and here's a legal term, maybe that tolls the statute of limitation. Maybe the clock doesn't start ticking until all these other things are resolved. And what the court said is, no, that's not the case for a First Amendment lawsuit, right? Don't wait, right? You know, we start the clock ticking when the bad thing happens, when either the bad thing happens or you learn about the bad thing. Here, the bad thing was he was fired, right? And, or maybe he was placed on leave before he was fired could have been the thing. He knew about it when it happened. And so the clock started ticking and his suit, which was filed more than 2 years after the termination, was viewed as untimely. With respect to his Title VII claims, his discrimination claims, they failed. You know, the court said basically that, you know, the employer did have a legitimate reason, right, for imposing the discipline. There were alleged, and ultimately there were proven to be violations of the employer's policy. Now, maybe the violations weren't sufficient enough to warrant termination in arbitration, but the employer certainly had a reason for doing what they were doing, right? The charges weren't mere pretext, as we might say in my profession. The officer in this case made the videos. The employer believed they were inappropriate, and that's why they acted, because of the videos. They weren't just trying out to get him. And you know, that's another thing, another reason why we're talking about the case, because you know, in one, it stands for two things. You know, for with respect to the people who listen to this podcast, one is, you know, filing a grievance isn't going to toll the statute of limitations. So if you've got a termination case where somebody has individual rights, whether they're, you know, maybe discrimination, anti-discrimination protections from state or federal law or local law, or whether there are constitutional claims, you know, they've got to act on that or not act on that. And that's, the union really shouldn't be involved in that. You say, hey, that's up to you and your personal lawyer. If your lawyer wants to talk to the union's lawyer, we can help coordinate or something, but don't wait for this arbitration to be done, because you might find yourself out of luck, which is exactly what happened with respect to the First Amendment claim. And the other thing is, you know, that different laws and different standards are going to result in different outcomes on the very same facts. And so here, the Title VII claim was dealt with on the merits, and the plaintiff, this police officer, was unsuccessful. And the court determined that there wasn't a violation of law regarding his termination. Whereas the same facts and the same termination was overturned by an arbitrator that found, you know, when you apply traditional just cause principles to this matter, while there may have been cause for discipline, termination was excessive. And so same facts, different outcomes. You got to know your forum and make sure from the union's perspective, you're advising, you know, grievance or potential plaintiffs that if you think you've got a charge or you've got something else that you can file, good luck and God bless. Go ahead and pursue that. Keep us posted, but don't wait for the grievance to be resolved, because the clock is ticking. Do not delay. Case number two isn't too terribly far from Cuyahoga County. It's on the other side of Lake Erie. We're going to go over to the state of New York and the great city of Rochester, New York. And this is a case involving the Firefighters Union in New York. It's called Rochester Firefighters Association versus City of Rochester. And this is an unfair practice case. So this is a ULP charge filed by the union. Spoiler alert, the union was unsuccessful. What are we talking about here? All right. So folks in New York State who are listening to this might know that in the middle of COVID, the state passed a healthcare worker bonus program. And this was basically, there were financial incentives. This was all ARPA money, you know, financial incentives to frontline healthcare workers, you know, to keep them on the job, right? To keep them from quitting, keep them from walking away. Or taking other jobs in the private sector, et cetera, et cetera, right? And so New York had this healthcare worker bonus program. It could have been as high as $3,000, you know, per worker. I think they paid it out in installments. You know, if as long as you don't quit, you know, we'll give you another $1,000, then another $1,000, et cetera. And the kicker, New York, my folks who live in New York who are listening to this know, New York has not insignificant state income taxes, right? I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm on the Pennsylvania side of the line. So I know the difference between the PA and the New York side of the line with respect to income taxes. And that bonus, the healthcare worker bonus payment, was not subject to New York state income tax, right? So it was supposed to be this tax-free benefit that was issued. Great. So people who work for the fire department, I don't know if everybody got it. I don't know if how that broke down. or if it was only some members of the fire department, I don't know. And Rochester folks, you know, hey, follow up with me, let me know. If that department, if everybody, what they do with respect to EMS deployment, if there's a third service in Rochester, if it's a fire and EMS department, if everybody therefore was eligible for the bonus or not, I have no idea. I just know that some people in that bargaining unit, probably a significant number of people, were eligible for and received the healthcare worker bonus program money, and they received it in 2023. And so what happens in the beginning part of 2024, the city issues W-2s. And what does the city do? We have employers who listen to this podcast. God bless you. Thank you for your service. But what did the employer do? They messed up their W-2s. We get so many payroll issues and cases that come up in this practice. It's just like, how hard is it to get the pay rate? I don't know. It shouldn't be that hard. But the city messes up the W-2s because they report the bonus payments as taxable. Look, nobody's perfect. It's a screw up. The union raises that, calls it to the city's attention. The city did the right thing and they corrected the W-2s. Don't let your employer tell you they can't do that. There's a form. It's a W-2C. I'm guessing C is in correction. You file a W-2C if you're an employer, if you've messed up the W-2s. So they did correct it. They did reissue W-2s. So shout out to the city of Rochester for doing the right thing. But then the union wanted to talk about like, okay, well, what do we do about this, right? You messed up. You were okay about it, right? After we called your attention to it and some hemming and hawing back and forth, you agreed to reissue the W-2s. Okay, that's good. But how are you going to make it right with our members? Because, you know, we've had some people, by the time this was worked out, they've paid their taxes, right? You know, their refund wasn't as big or their tax payment was larger than it should have been. You have to make them whole, right? Or if they're going to have to refile taxes that they've already filed, if they're going to have to pay accounting fees, right? You have to pay an accountant to like fix this stuff. You're going to have to make us whole for that. And there's a process. Let's sit down and figure out how people were harmed, and you're going to have to cut a check. And it's just like the cost of doing business. You made a mistake. Let's make it right. The city didn't do any of that, right? They sat, they met with them, you know, they fixed the W-2s, but at the end of that process, that's all they did. They said, we're not going to pay anybody's accounting fees. We're not going to make anybody whole. You know, the IRS will make them whole eventually. This was before Elon Musk, you know, fired everybody who worked at the IRS. And, the union filed a charge in response to that and basically argued that the city was refusing to bargain by refusing to take any steps at all to address the harms, you know, that were caused by its screw up. And that charge was unsuccessful. The labor board in New York kicked that and determined that by sitting down, by meeting with the union, by correcting the W-2s, the city had engaged in what the board called reasonable effort. And the board said that reasonable effort was enough. And there wasn't any obligation to provide any additional compensation to employees as a result of that. And one of the things that the case turned on, it was interesting, is that, you know, what were the harms really, right? And how connected were they to work? And the board basically said, well, these were personal financial consequences, like tax liability, amending your tax returns. These are personal tax issues. And the employer doesn't have to fix somebody's personal tax issues. You know, if they have any other personal tax issues, the employer doesn't have to address those. There wasn't a sufficient nexus, you know, between the thing that we're talking about and employment, at least according to the labor board. And because of that, the board determined that the city satisfied its obligation to bargain. You know, I don't know that I agree with the labor board on that one. Sometimes I do when they rule against the union. You know, I can't see how if the employer screws up the W-2 and it causes harms, you can credibly argue that that's not related to employment. You created a problem as the employer. It's directly related to wages and benefits. In this case, it's directly related to wages. I just don't see how that falls outside of a bargaining obligation. But, you know, I'm not on the labor board, so it doesn't really matter what I think. Why am I talking about the case? Well, I'm talking about it, one, because I think it's interesting facts, but two, this is like dead on point to an issue that comes up at every one of our seminars and has for the last year or since last summer. And that is no tax on overtime, right? I'm not going to bore you with the facts of no tax on overtime. But you can check out our TikTok if you want to learn more about that. But, you know, you're supposed to, right, for 2025, if people are listening to this, you've probably already filed your taxes, or if you haven't, you better get them filed. You can take a tax deduction for some of your overtime. It's not no tax on overtime, but there is a deduction for qualified overtime, you know, subject to caps. It's only the half and time and a half, right? There's like a million, you know, little extra kind of small print items that make it not really no tax on overtime, but it can be a significant tax deduction of, you know, $12,500 if you're single. If you're married, filing jointly, it's up to $25,000. That's a pretty significant cut in your taxable income, and there are benefits there if you can avail yourself of it. The problem for police and fire and corrections, or people who work on unusual schedules, is that your overtime, and in a unionized workplace, you're going to get overtime in situations where John Q. Public wouldn't get overtime under just the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so, you know, the only overtime that's deductible under the no tax on overtime provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act of 2025 is what they call qualified overtime, which is what really means FLSA overtime. So overtime that the employer would have to pay you under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And so under the Fair Labor Standards Act, you get, you know, pay for hours worked over 40, overtime for hours worked over 40 in a work week. If you take sick leave for a day or two, well, you didn't work, you're 40. So if you get called in for an extra shift on the weekend, that's going to be straight time, not overtime under that law. Or if you're held over 3 hours beyond your regular scheduled shift, you're not going to get overtime for that under the Fair Labor Standards Act, unless when you go through the rest of the week, it adds up to hours physically worked beyond 40. And so it's not as simple. Some people say, well, you just look at the overtime reported in your W-2 for 2025. You divide that by three, right? That's the half and time and a half, I guess. And you take that as a deduction. That may be true if you work at Walmart, but it's not true if you're a police officer. And you know what we've seen, unfortunately, in places is that people's W-2s are messed up with respect to this issue. Now, 2025's W-2, we can get it because the law, you know, I can understand it being screwed up because the law was passed mid-year. But unions, employers, you got to get out ahead of this for 2026. And so this same issue that they faced in Rochester, you know, it may be that Rochester is going to face this same exact issue now, except they want to talk to the city about correcting W-2s that were issued for 2025 regarding qualified overtime, because the overtime that was reported in the W-2 is not the overtime that people can take as a deduction. And what's going to have to happen? Someone's going to have to hire an accountant to unwind that. And so this Rochester case at least says, this case, these facts, if the employer, now in that case, the employer did reissue the W-2, that's great. But, you know, does an employer even have to do that? If an employer refuses to do anything about the no tax on overtime provisions, is that bargainable or not? I would suggest to you that it is, but you should take a look at that Rochester case if you have any interest in this moving forward. And if you haven't, you know, formed a committee, if you haven't started a process of you know, the union and employer folks to sit down and figure out how are you going to report out, you know, qualified overtime over the next few years so that people can take advantage of this tax deduction, you should do it. You know, please do it. Get started talking about that stuff so that we don't wind up in the same mess next year. This deduction is temporary. It goes away. It only applies in tax years 25, 26, 27, 28. It'll probably be extended because that's just the way temporary tax cuts work. But even if it's only temporary, we have three more years that we got to deal with it. So let's take be inspired by the Rochester case and try to apply those lessons over to no tax on overtime and see if we can avoid some headaches before they happen. For case number three, we are going to turn south and go not too far south, state of New York. We're going to go to the state of New Jersey, and we're going to have a corrections case coming out of New Jersey. Corrections cases are always my favorite because the facts are always the best. We got a New Jersey corrections officer who was disciplined, got a 30-day suspension for what? For social media activity. I love the social media cases. And so this one is kind of interesting too. there was a lot of social media stuff. So this guy was posting on his Facebook page, like internal emails and internal work stuff, and just kind of putting it out there. The most controversial were internal Department of Correction emails about the department's Black Leadership Conference. And there was lots of posts criticizing that event as, you know, discriminatory, DEI, you know, the prison's got a DEI, you know, conference that they're running. You know, this is bullshit. Is this taxpayer, you know, the way taxpayer money should be spent? Blah, blah, blah. It's that kind of stuff that the person, and I'm not quoting the post, right? But that's basically what was going on. Someone was complaining about that stuff, about these DEI things. The officer, you know, claimed that, you know, in his defense, the department initiated an investigation into these posts. And there were other posts. He had posted regularly about unsafe conditions and understaffing, right? You know, he was, you know, posting about a lot of different things, but the ones that really were deemed most problematic to the department were the, you know, the DEI related posts. He claimed he was just trying to, he was engaging in concerted activity. He was rallying coworkers. He was trying to generate opposition, you know, to a policy that affected, you know, all COs. And so, you know, when we're looking at whether some conduct is protected under law, under your state labor law, there's two terms that we hear, protected and we hear concerted. And if your activity is protected and concerted, right? So if it's a protected right, and it's not just about you, it's about, you know, the group, about the union, you're going to have, generally going to have protections under the law. And if it's not, you're not. And so, there was also another claim that, that was interesting in this case, that I want to mention before we talk about what the labor board did with it. And there's a Weingarten claim, and I love Weingarten cases too. And so Weingarten, rights are the right to have a union representative with you, basically. Right. So if you are being interviewed by your employer about something that could result in discipline, you have the right to request a union representative, and the employer is going to have to provide a union representative there. If you don't ask for it, the right doesn't exist. Some state laws will provide better benefits where they do have to notify you. Some contracts will bake in those protections, but the general Weingarten protection is the right to a union rep for an investigatory interview when the employee asks. You know, there's notice baked in there and some kind of reasonable information. And, you know, there are other Weingarten protections, you know, that we see, but the gist of it is the right to a union representative. Now here in this particular case, the Weingarten violation that was alleged was that the employer didn't tell the employee anything about what they were going to interview this officer about. Like, first of all, he knew what they were calling him in about. He's posting all this stuff online, right? And they say, we want to conduct a workplace interview. And, you know, he requested, or his union requested some type of explanation in advance of the interview of what they were going to ask the officer about, right? Which, by the way, I think is a pretty reasonable request. And the employer didn't do that. The employer said, nope, we're not going to do that. The detailed explanation of the content of the interview was alleged misconduct, right? So I want to interview you about what? About alleged misconduct. Well, can you be more specific? No, right? Just alleged misconduct. You know, I don't know. I got a problem with that. I think that you need to give an employee a little more information. I don't know that you need to go through everything in detail, but why wouldn't you, by the way? Employers, like, let me know what you think about this. I always think that when employers hold, especially in law enforcement, sometimes guys, by the way, law enforcement investigations, internal affairs investigations, you think like these guys would actually like be good at investigations? And sometimes they're terrible. I mean, they just are. And I think sometimes people get caught up in this like game of gotcha. And I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to interview you about, right? You know, because I don't want you to get time to get your story straight, you know? And I would just say that, as a general observation, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, on this at our discipline seminars. We're going to have a discipline webinar later this year, like a multi-part webinar about the stuff that we kind of take a deep dive on this stuff. And I always feel like, well, what are you hiding? Right? You know, why would we hide the ball? Why don't we use the investigation process to get all of our cards on the table? You know, and you know, from the employer's perspective, if you're going to interview somebody about their Facebook posts, you know, aren't you in a stronger position on the back end? You know, if somebody said, because everybody, by the way, everybody says the investigation is unfair. Everybody who has ever been disciplined in the history of discipline believes the investigation was not fair. That's just reality, right? So they're always going to raise that argument. And when they raise the argument, wouldn't you be better off in saying, well, we gave the employee 48 hours notice of the interview. They asked us what the interview was about. We said it was about alleged violations of our social media policy. You know, then we talked to them 2 days later. The employee can't say at the interview after the fact, well, I was surprised. I didn't know what you were going to talk to me about. And there were things that didn't occur to me that occurred to me a day or two later. So now the statement that you took from me isn't accurate, right? Like there's reasons why you just want to get all that stuff, give people notice so that when they try to change their story after the interview, you can say, no way, man, you had 2 days to prepare. You've thought about it. You can't say you were surprised. Like I feel like notice and specificity actually helps management more than it helps the employee. So I'm mystified as to why employers don't do that. Just alleged misconduct is what they said here. You know, not sure what the backstory is there. So, all right, we have this employee. He's interviewed. They don't tell him what he's interviewed about. They wind up giving him a 30-day suspension. And he files a charge alleging a series of violations. One of the allegations is this Weingarten thing. And he was unsuccessful on the Weingarten charge. And the PERC basically determined that the employer does not, you know, under Jersey standards, need to provide a detailed explanation of the possible charges. You just need to be general. I would suggest to you that alleged misconduct is a little too general. But, you know, the labor board disagreed with me. It's two cases where I disagree with the labor board. There's no obligation on the employer's part, unless you've negotiated same, to preview evidence or specifics. It's just Weingarten doesn't go that far in New Jersey. Again, I think a little more specificity would have been helpful here. But hey, the Weingarten charge then was kicked. What about the argument about the social media activity being protected and concerted? Hey, this is our second social media case, you know, this podcast. We talked in the first case, right, you know, about somebody that might have protections under, in this officer's particular case in Cuyahoga County, he had protections under the First Amendment, and he might have had protections under Title VII if the discipline was implemented, you know, in any type of discriminatory way. And then he was unsuccessful on both those, one because it was like not timely, not on the merits, but he was really successful on just cause. Are there any other areas of protection that you might have in social media? Well, this Jersey case picks up the other area. So, and that's, you might have protections under your state labor law. So if you post something on social media, you might have constitutional protections. You might have protections against retaliation under, you know, state or federal anti-discrimination laws. You might have protections under your state labor law. And you might have protections under a collective bargaining agreement, right? Those are generally the four areas that we might see. And so this Jersey case gives us that fourth area. But, you know, it's not a guarantee, right? It's not a guarantee. And in this case, in fact, the conduct was not determined to be protected. And so the labor board in the Jersey corrections case basically said that these were not, it wasn't concerted activity, these social media posts. This was one person who was unhappy with the way things were going in the corrections in the Department of Corrections and was complaining about it online. The court used the term, or the board uses the term, personal griping. Right, so personal griping isn't protected. It wasn't tied to any issue that was active in bargaining. It wasn't tied to contract enforcement. And even though the employee argued that it wasn't really tied to any type of group action, at least the DEI-related social media posts. Some of the posts, though, were. And so the posts that were related to safety, the safe staffing concerns and a post that related to, you know, needing more union activity, those clearly were. And so it was a bit of a split decision from the labor board with respect to these cases, with respect to the 30-day suspension that was issued here. The claims, the discipline for posts about unsafe staffing were protected activity, and the concerns about the DEI stuff were not protected. So an interesting case. It kind of covers like the other side of social media stuff. And, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say, hey, listen, guys, just don't, you know, how do I feel about it? if you've got one member of the bargaining unit popping off about like safety issues, even on their Facebook page, I would love that stuff to be, why does it need to come from one officer? Can it, like, let's have that stuff come from the union. So there can be some strategy, that we can make sure that we're not losing the point of the post, maybe in like profane language or in other things. I would love it if we could control that stuff more, but the problem, with people is that, especially people who post unreasonable things on Facebook, or YouTube or whatever, is that they don't tend to be the most reasonable people in the world. So there are protections out there. Occasionally, we have to use them, but best practice would be to stay off of social media, for anything having to do with your job. Okay. The final two cases for us this month are both Brady Giglio, cases, and they, are interesting, to me anyway, because they show kind of two different views of the issue. One case coming out of Pennsylvania, another case out of North Carolina. And so let's start with the Pennsylvania case and just a little bit of background about Brady and Giglio, rules. We've got, requirements that prosecutors in a criminal prosecution disclose certain information to defendants, so that those defendants, can receive a fair trial. The primary case, that stands for this proposition is U.S. v. Brady. And there's another case, the Giglio decision, or Giglio, depending on how you roll, that was decided a few years later, that essentially applied this general Brady rule, which is you have to disclose exculpatory information to a defendant, a criminal defendant in a criminal case, applied that to information that could be used to cross-examine a witness in a case. So if you have information regarding a potential witness in the government, in the prosecution's case, and that's information that the defense could use to cross-examine a government witness, you need to provide that information to the defense. And that's the Giglio decision. And that's the decision that is most at issue for police officers, right? Last time I checked, police officers tend to be witnesses, for the prosecution. And if we have a case where there's something that a defense attorney might want to cross-examine a police officer about, especially if they're the main witness in the case against the client, if that police officer received a 10-day suspension for lying, a year before this arrest, and I'm representing a criminal defendant, am I going to want to know about that? Hell yeah, right? That might be something I want to, raise during cross-examination if this officer's credibility is at issue. And I may or may not be able to ask those questions. The judge is going to, guide us through that process. But this is really a disclosure rule. There's nothing wrong with the rule. We want good convictions, right? We want, bad guys who go to jail to stay in jail, or at least that's what I would like to see. So you want, good prosecutions, good convictions that are going to hold up. So you want to make sure that people's constitutional rights are honored, right? The problem that we see with Brady Giglio is that oftentimes prosecutors or employers take shortcuts or take a lazy approach to this, and they say, hey, listen, if there's any instance in where you're a police officer that might have a Brady Giglio issue, so you might have a 10-day suspension for lying on your record, well, you can't be a police officer anymore. Why? Well, because police officers testify in court. And if you can't testify in court, then you can't be a police officer. Like, that's the shorthand version of it. And that is completely wrong. It is completely and totally wrong. That's not what the rule is. That's not how it is applied. But oftentimes we have prosecutors and we have police departments that try to use the Brady Giglio rule as a sword, right, to rid a department of what they would believe is a bad police officer. We've seen it a lot more recently. I think the last few years it's started to quiet down a little bit, but we had that era of kind of progressive prosecutors that, people who ran for office to be a DA, and like one of their campaign prongs was, I'm going to fire bad cops, or I'm going to prosecute bad cops. Or if I can't prosecute a bad cop, a so-called bad cop, I'm going to try to force their employer to get rid of them. How? Well, I'm going to say that they can't, I'm not going to prosecute any case involving that police officer. They're useless now. So you have like people that are trying to force police departments to fire police officers. And there's lots of entities out there that help them do that. You know, if you're interested, just Google Brady Cop, Giglio Cop. You'll find all kinds of stories and websites where people try to list this stuff. All right, enough background. We got a case out of Pennsylvania, Cox versus SEPTA. SEPTA is the regional transit authority in the Philadelphia area. They have their own police department. This case, there is a SEPTA police officer who is involved in an arrest. She gets into a physical struggle with a suspect, and we've got a use of force. And the allegation in that case was, you know, at the end of the struggle, after the suspect was restrained, the officer struck the suspect again, and that last action was inappropriate, was an excessive use of force. That's the allegation. The department investigates this. So we have an internal affairs investigation. At the conclusion of the investigation, the department concludes that the officer engaged in excessive force, and they conclude that the officer lied during the interviews. So there were statements that were inconsistent with evidence. They conclude that there was dishonesty. All right. They move forward with the discipline and they fire the officer. Officer's terminated. What does the employer do after that? And this is where, I don't know, this is the stuff that I don't like. And whether some employers might say they're required to do this, others might say it's just a way to try to harm somebody. So they already fired this officer. So what does SEPTA do? After they fire the officer, they notify the DA that they fired an officer for dishonesty. Why did they do that? So that the DA, who's a DA that is one of these DAs that ran on the, you know, on a platform of not liking police officers, quite frankly, is Larry Krasner. He's the DA of the city of Philadelphia. He's probably the most anti-cop district attorney I've ever dealt with, you know, my entire career. And I do this all over the country, right? So they notify the anti-cop DA. And what does the DA do? He issues a Giglio letter to the officer saying, I'm not going to prosecute any case. You can't testify in any case in Philadelphia County because your employer gave me this notice that you're a liar. By the way, that's not a reason, you know, to not prosecute a case. You might have to like think hard and maybe do your job differently, but it's not automatic. There was no due process, no nothing. The DA just kind of gave the letter, said you can't testify, and there we go. What did the officer do in response? So the officer sued SEPTA, pretty interesting. The officer sued SEPTA, and she raises a race discrimination allegation, not a gender discrimination claim. And the officer argued basically that white officers in a similar situation were treated better than she was. Another one of these kind of burden shifting cases, like we talked about already. What happens in this case is when someone wants to raise a claim like this, you're basically going to say, I was fired for doing X, right? And I was treated differently from other officers who also did X. And then the burden shifts over to the employer to say, no, we didn't, here's why we treated your case this way. Here's why we treated the other cases the other way. Nothing was based on race. We kind of called it like we saw it. We didn't even get to that point here because the court determined that this particular officer was not qualified for the job anymore. And that why? Because there was a Giglio letter. So this Brady Giglio letter that the DA issued led a federal court, to conclude that this particular officer was not able to testify ever, which is wrong. And because they weren't able to testify, they were not able to fulfill a core job function of being a police officer, which is also wrong. The court gave the analogy of like, well, maybe if you need a security clearance to do a certain job, that's what this is, which is also wrong. But that's what the court said. You know, the court basically said, look, we're not going to get into balancing. We're not going to get into your allegations regarding how this police department addressed other uses of force, because as far as we understand, under Brady Giglio standards, the fact that this DA has said you can't testify in Philadelphia County means that you are unemployable. And that's where it ended. And this was the Third Circuit decision. You know, it's unpublished, but it's a Third Circuit decision, you know, in this part of the country. And it shows really a couple of things. It shows one, how the degree to which federal courts do not understand this concept, which is very troubling. And it also just shows these other ways that abuse of the Brady and Giglio process can harm police officers, right? So here, they didn't fire the officer because of the Giglio letter, which sometimes, you know, departments will try to do. If they don't have enough evidence to fire somebody, they'll get a DA that might be friendly to issue a Giglio letter. And then they can say, oh, we didn't want to fire you, but the DA can't use you, so you're fired now. Like, sometimes you see that. That's really troubling. Here, they didn't do that, but they did do it after the fact. And I have seen employers take that step. And I think what SEPTA was really trying to do here, without knowing, but what this employer was probably trying to do here, was bolster their case if there was a challenge or a grievance or an arbitration to try to get an officer back to work. And I don't know whether there was or there wasn't, but a lot of times an employer will do that and they'll say, by the time you get to the arbitration hearing, oh, yeah, well, you know, even if there wasn't cause to terminate the officer, you can't reinstate them because the DA won't let them testify in this county anymore. I've dealt with that argument, I've knocked down that argument a bunch of times in cases, but it's conduct that we see. So really troubling case that shows just different ways that this Brady Giglio, the misunderstandings about Brady Giglio standards can harm people. This in a case that was indirect, you know, a Title VII case brought by an officer who may have been fired because of her race. We just don't know because of the way the courts apply the Brady Giglio rule. One of the things that's disturbing, that's most disturbing to me about the Cox versus SEPTA case, because it comes from a part of the country that I live in, and it comes from a part of the country where I litigate cases. And I know that the rule, right, in this part of the country or in this state is that there are constitutional due process protections that are afforded to police officers with respect to their placement on or their possible removal from a Brady or Giglio list. And that's to add all of, you know, what are the benefits of due process to make sure that people don't get steamrolled and to make sure that there's a little bit of sunlight and record on a process. And so if in Pennsylvania, a police officer is placed on a Giglio list and told by a DA that they can't testify in their county and they disagree with that, they have a right to appeal and have a hearing, you know, before an independent third party who will determine whether, in fact, that restriction is appropriate or not. That flows from a case filed by FOP Lodge 5, you know, in the city of Philadelphia. There's a reported decision in Pennsylvania on that from, I think, 2021 or 2022 that sets up that right. And those are the rules that we operate under here. And so, you know, none of that apparently, you know, came up in that Cox versus SEPTA case. And, you know, that's concerning. All right, well, let's go to North Carolina since we're talking about constitutional protections, because that is the exact argument, you know, the due process right that I just told you about in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania is the same right that's at issue in a case out of North Carolina. And this case was issued a few months ago. It's called Leach v. State. I think we reported that out in our last newsletter. And this is a case that arises out of Roxboro, North Carolina. And, you know, this is another interesting case. It's another, the Philadelphia case, or the SEPTA case, was a use of force and lying during an investigation. Here we've got an officer responds to, it's a rape call, and officers on scene and kind of going through the crime scene afterwards, and finds a box cutter in the victim's bedroom, and confirms, at least the record reflects, that the officer confirmed with earlier officers on scene and also ran through his sergeant that the box cutter was like unrelated to any allegations or anything in the alleged crime. And so he threw it away. Later during the criminal prosecutions, the DA learns more about this. The DA finds out about the box cutter being missing. They ask the officer what happened. The officer says that he had approval to discard the box cutter. And the DA doesn't believe that. The DA thinks the officer was lying about having approval. And so what does the DA do? And this doesn't come from the department. The DA issues a Giglio letter to the officer saying, we believe that you were dishonest with us and in regard to your evidence mishandling. And therefore, we will not use you as a witness in any cases in this county moving forward, right? Same stuff that we heard about in Pennsylvania. Now, what does the department do in response? The department fires him. You know, okay, well, you got a Giglio letter now from the DA. You can't work here anymore because you can't testify in a case. So I guess we're going to fire you because there's just no way to fight your placement on a Giglio letter, at least according to that police department. Now, North Carolina has a law on this stuff. It's a pretty bad law, as far as I'm concerned. It's the only one in the country that deals with Brady Giglio issues the way that it does. There are some good state laws on this. New Hampshire's got a pretty neat system. Iowa actually's got a very good system. Florida, pretty good law. And basically with those, the states that address this, they just codify the constitutional requirements that exist here anyway, and they build a structure around it so that we can not have these Brady Giglio decisions be made in the dark, in secret by some DA somewhere. And we don't know their involvement with the police department. We don't, you know, there's lots of bad things that can happen with respect to those determinations. And so there's state statutes that kind of build a structure around that. North Carolina doesn't do that. It's a really different approach. They create like a red flag database. Police officers don't like being put in red flag databases, by the way. And so the state statute in North Carolina requires every Giglio letter has to be reported to a state database so that they can maintain a state database and they know who the bad Brady Giglio cops are, so that you can't go and work in another place, basically, I think is kind of the idea. I don't know. It requires disclosure of those letters. And there's nothing in that process that talks about, there's no due process. There's no meaningful right to a hearing. There's limited disclosure. And in the Leach case, Officer Leach wound up suing, challenging his termination. And one of the arguments that he raised was he challenged the very constitutionality of North Carolina's Brady Giglio law because there are no due process procedures built into the state statute, and essentially argued that he was deprived of due process first by the DA for putting him on the list with, I would suggest he's arguing he's no cause, and also against his police department for relying on this letter. And they're all relying on the state statute, and they're all saying the state statute is requiring us to do this. And it's all built on an unconstitutional foundation in one lawyer's view. And so I understand why they brought the challenge. In the decision is not too terribly significant, you know, for this issue. What wound up happening, the motion to dismiss, and the employer appended some evidence, introduced some new evidence in litigating the motion to dismiss, which led the court to say, well, what we really are talking about here is a summary judgment motion then, since we have this evidence and the plaintiff haven't had an opportunity to respond. And so the court remanded everything back to the trial court and had them do discovery. And I think that's where it stands right now. And so the claims against the DA are going to proceed. The constitutional challenges to the statute are proceeding. And the real question there is what degree of due process is required before we make this type of career impacting Giglio designation. It doesn't need to be career ending, by the way, career impacting. What do I mean by that? Plenty of arbitration awards out there, plenty of arbitration decisions that we reported at LRS where, if somebody is subject to some type of testimonial limitation, and sometimes these are temporary, sometimes it's like for a year or two, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, honestly, but a lot of times they're temporary. You'll have cases where an arbitrator will say, okay, you know, just because this person is subject to a disclosure obligation, that's all that's required, is that, you know, parts of their work record be disclosed to defense counsel. It doesn't mean, one, that they can never be a witness in any case. And it certainly doesn't mean that they can't perform other aspects of their police job. And, you know, a lot of times arbitrators will treat that as almost like a reasonable accommodation, and courts on review will treat that as essentially a reasonable accommodation requirement on a police department. So it's just not so simple to say, oh, Brady letter never uses a witness, you can't work as a police officer. That's just not the case. And so we're talking about the Leach case because we're going to keep an eye on it, right? You know, it's an example of officers attacking this system, in order to ensure constitutional protections. Constitutional protections apply not just to criminal defendants, but also to members of the prosecution team. And so we want to make sure that everybody's rights are protected. In this instance, it's a police officer. And so it's a case we want to keep an eye on closely as we continue to monitor these Brady and Giglio developments in different parts of the country. Okay, that's it for the podcast this month. Hope you enjoyed the cases. You know, if you enjoy the podcast, you know, text it to your friends, you know, share it, like, follow, whatever the things that people say. I'm saying to you now on a podcast, you know, so spread the word. Check us out at LRS.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon. Signing off, Rick Polson. I will see y'all in May.